The Saskatchewan Healthcare Coalition is hosting the All for Public Healthcare Rally in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, May 4th. It's free and you're invited. This rally is happening because our public healthcare system does not have the support it needs to meet the diverse needs of all Saskatchewan residents. For years, it has been underfunded, ignored, and hindered, so join Donna and I in person on May 4th in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan for a walk, speeches, networking, and community building. Link for more information is in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Chad Valier survived sexual abuse, homelessness, addiction, PTSD, and against all odds, Chad emerges, owing his metamorphosis to the power of recovery and peer support. Alongside his inspiring personal story, Chad also gives us an insider's look into his life as a musician, fronting the band Valier, and he tells us about the documentary featuring his story, Up From the Dark. Chad is a potent display of resilience and redemption. What's up, everybody? My name's Dan, and this is Hard Knocks Talks, your addictions podcast. I tried to shorten this episode, but every word was attached to valuable insight, so buckle up. We're jumping on the roller coaster ride that is Chad Valier. What's up, Chad?
Hey, man, how's it going?
It's going good. Sorry. Anyone who might not know, this is like the third crack we've had at this with endless tech problems, so I don't know. Are you still in a good mood? Should we still do this?
Yes, I'm in. Always.
All right, let's go.
This is Hard Knocks Talks.
If you are struggling with the substance use of a loved one or a tragically lost a loved one to drug-related harms, reach out to Stronger Together Canada, peer-led support groups by Mums Stop the Harm. If you are in search of private inpatient addictions treatment, check out Prairie Sky Recovery Center located in Libsig, Saskatchewan. If you are looking for help with criminal record suspensions, the Elizabeth Fry Society of Saskatchewan covers all associated costs for women or gender-diverse individuals to apply for criminal record suspensions. Reach out to Chelsea at 306-668-0653. To make contact or learn more about today's sponsors, check out our new merch, or if you want to show us some love and buy us a coffee, all of those links are in the show notes below. Now, you're in Ontario, correct?
Yeah, Oshawa, just outside of Toronto.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on over there with like the homeless encampments and things like that.
Well, the drug epidemic is off the chain. Like Oshawa is a cesspool right now. And the homeless, like there are so many homeless people, and it's to the point where there's tent cities just about everywhere. And I mean, these tent cities are so extreme right now that it's almost like they have their own civilization. Like they've got their own world, their own language, their own rules, and they just keep shoving these people like as far away as they can and not dealing with it. And even like that's actually something that I'm really concerned about, and something that I hope to try to get involved in is some way to fix it. Because even if you get these people off drugs, what are you going to do with them? Mm-hmm. You know, you can only, you know, they don't have any social etiquette, any skills. I mean, they're just going to get off dope and then what? And still be homeless. I mean, the disability here, like the checks wouldn't even cover, like rent is so off the chain in the city. Mm-hmm. Like you're lucky if you can get a one bedroom apartment for under $2,000.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And what are you going to do when the average disability check in Ontario is like 11 to 13?
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be living in a room, and sadly drug addicts don't come with a nest egg or good credit. So how do you even get an apartment?
Well, right? And that's something that we're noticing here too. It's when they do manage to get someone housed, that's hard to house or into treatment or anything like that. By the time they come out of treatment, or by the time their temporary housing has expired or whatever, there's right. nowhere left for them to go except back where they came from. And then they get told they're not trying hard enough and the cycle continues.
Well, exactly. And then what do you do? Like you take a guy who or a girl and they don't even know how to act in proper situations because they haven't had to. And they're, you know, you throw them into a situation where it requires that sort of skill and they're going to ruin it probably. Because they haven't learned anything. Nobody's taught them, and anything they did know has gone by the wayside because they're in survival mode, right? And then what?
So what worked for you then? I mean, you before the show, you told me the first time you got loaded, you were like 2 years old, and you were so hungover you didn't even want to open your Christmas presents. So, coming through a light, and we'll go back to that. We're definitely going to talk more about that. But on point with what we're talking about now, as far as not having life skills and things like that, how did you start to learn those things when you came into recovery?
Okay, so when I was in active use, I would cling to the people I could get things from. So I took almost the same approach in recovery. So when I saw people who had what I wanted, you know, I worked my way into that maybe group of people, you know, and whether it was honest or dishonest, it kept me clean at the time, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wasn't quite at a point where I had 100% given up, you know, these people I think are, and they don't care anymore. So if they got to bite your face off to get something to eat, they probably wouldn't hesitate.
Yeah.
And I hadn't quite gotten to that point, thank God, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's rock bottom is very different, clearly, right? Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate to not, you know, I was homeless for sure, but I could still talk my way into a meal here or there or company or somewhere to sleep, like a couch or, you know, things like that. Whereas, you know, I could score a shower. Mm-hmm. You know, I was not homeless under a bridge, you know, like a lot of people get. So my rock bottom, fortunately, wasn't as bad as some of these. But again, even, you know, learning how to not be like talk certain ways and conduct myself certain ways was still a tough skill, you know, because I still carried a street persona, you know, trying to be tough or trying to be, you know, intimidating or whatever it took to get what I wanted. Right. So you said, it took me a long time to get out of those habits.
You said streets, mentality. Were you involved in the gangs? Were you involved in organized
not
crime?
Gangs per se, not gangs per se, but I mean, I stole dope and I, you know, I associated with people who did the same sort of things and I was brought up around, you know, motorcycle clubs and, you know, I was raised around all that stuff and this code of the street that I was taught from a very young age. Right. So you learn, that's what you learn. That's what you know. And I'm not, you know, crapping on motorcycle clubs per se. I'm saying, but there's some that aren't very nice. And when you learn that sort of behavior and you see things going on around you as a child that children shouldn't see, you know what I mean? That's a lifestyle that was ingrained into my head from the time I was very little. It was not uncommon to have a house full of those types of people.
So speaking of which, why don't you take us back for a few minutes here? Now, like your earliest memory from what you told me is being hungover on Christmas morning at 2 years old and not wanting to, like, where did it go from there?
I mean, I remember the story being like, they were trying to wake me up to open presents and I was telling them to leave me alone because I was too hungover because I had stolen drinks off the table. And you know, from there, you know, like I said, the kind of behaviors that were going on in my house around us, it wasn't good, but I didn't know any better. So I didn't even know it was different than other families until I went to other people's houses and they, you know, had multiple forks around a plate or, you know, a couple courses of dinner. You know, I didn't know what that was. Right. And then, you know, from the time I was old enough to know that stuff gave me a different feeling. You know, I was stealing booze out of my mom's fridge and stealing her dope and things like that. So drugs were just a common thing. Like it was done around me. And my mom's reasoning at the time, and I'm sure she would never do anything like that. Like I want to go on the record as to say, like, my mom is not a horrible person and she would never engage in these behaviors today. She's a wonderful grandmother to mine and my other siblings' children. But at the time, you know, she didn't know better either because she was raised in the same environment. And the way she thought was if she exposed me to it, I would see what it does to people and I would not want to do it. But it never looked like anybody was having a bad time. It always looked to me like everybody was having a blast until a fight would break out or a beer bottle would go over somebody's face or that kind of thing. And then you get scared for a minute, but you get used to it, right?
Yeah.
And then you start thinking that's how you deal with things. And in my house, you dealt with things with volume and violence, right? You yelled and you dealt with it. And if you didn't, you were treated as though you couldn't. So you didn't want to be treated as though you couldn't.
So
you did it.
What was it like for you when you went out into the world then? Now you must have, you know, going to school, elementary, high school, whatever. At what point did you start to realize, like, holy shit, I can't talk about some of the things that are going on at home?
Right away. I was taught from, like, whatever said in this house does not leave this house. And, you know, when the children's aid would show up, I'd be putting dope in my pocket to hide it. And I was told not to say anything. And believe it or not, through all that, I was like a gifted student. Like, all that was going on around me. Like, I'd get up to go to school and there'd still be people up partying. Mm-hmm. And I was still maintaining marks. But in grade seven, out of nowhere, I just failed. Like, I went from being in gifted classes to failing grade seven. Mm-hmm. But nobody asked questions. It was just like, well, what's going on with Chad? You know, it wasn't, wow, it must be his home. But I mean, people who were close to the situation, and this is where I had to learn to let some resentments go in my recovery later, was people knew this stuff was going on and nobody did anything, right? They left us to kind of fend for ourselves and nobody wanted to get involved. And maybe it was the type of people my parents associated with that didn't mm-hmm. allow them to get involved. But my mom, like, I lived mostly with my mom for the better part of my life. Uh-huh. And she was very violent, right? And so punishments were like, you'd get punched out. You know what I mean? You wouldn't get a smack in the mouth, you'd get beat. Or with whatever was in her hand, we'd get, you know, if it was a phone, if it was like anything, it was just always excessive force. And you know, I talk about this in the documentary. Like, I remember getting grounded, and I think I was 11 years old, and I went into my room in the winter and I got out in the spring, right? Wow. And it's funny because when you think about jail, right, when you're in jail, and I've never done any significant time, but what I've come to understand from jail is, you know, you can be in a cell with, like, you know, a killer or an arsonist, but to punish you, they put you by yourself because your brain is darker than any punishment mm-hmm. they could give you. So when you're 11 years old and you're in your room and the only thing you're allowed to do is go to school and come home, right? You get in there and this is not a good place for someone like me.
That's a really interesting point that I had never considered. Being incarcerated, it is worse to put you on your own than it is to put you with someone who may very well hurt you. That is like the ultimate form of punishment, is having to just deal with yourself.
Huh. Well, and if you're not prepared, and you learn that in recovery, right? You got to be comfortable in your skin. When you're already not, and they put you by yourself, like, I mean, there was a time I didn't leave my house without an entourage because the thought of being by myself was terrifying, right? Mm. But the cool thing, like, if there was one benefit about that was I was allowed to have a radio during that punishment. Mm. And I learned that I had a voice. So singing became my passion. Like, I watched these guys, you know, get all the things I wanted as a child, like, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That looked very attractive to me. Mm-hmm. Right. And these guys were leather, fire, sweat, hair. That was like superhero shit to me. Right.
Yeah.
And so that's what I strived for. Like, from the time I was 11 years old, it became about music. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I engulfed myself in music. And then with music comes more excess. Right.
Mm-hmm. Did you know, you just mentioned you wouldn't leave the house without an entourage because you couldn't stand being alone. Did you know that at the time? Yep. Or was this just,
no,
you just thought this was culture and this is what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, you got to have friends, right? You want to be the popular guy. You want to be cool. You want people to like you, mm-hmm. right? And that's all I wanted. And me, like, I've never had great self-esteem, not even as a child. Like, growing up in a, you know, net very close to poverty, mm-hmm. You know, we ate a lot of really garbage food. So it was a lot of macaroni and a lot of hot dogs. So I was like the fat kid. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, kids aren't exactly nice to each other. They're very cruel. Oh, so, man. You know, I was the fat kid and, you know, so when, you know, you learn to either fight or you learn how to make people laugh. And mm-hmm. if I couldn't make them laugh, I fought. Right. And I was better at making them laugh. I got to be honest, you know, but, you know, you learn survival. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know,
what did it look like when you left home? Did you leave amicably or did you get kicked out?
No, I got kicked out when I was 15. And the funny thing is my dad, like, both my parents are addicts, right? Yeah. And my dad did the geographical cure. Like, he moved. I don't know to this day, because my dad passed away when I was like 30. Mm-hmm. And it was actually the anniversary of his death on Boxing Day. But he, you know, I don't know if he actually did any of the internal work I just know for a while he kept carrying on, and then he slowed down, right? So my mom punished me by kicking me out and making me move in with him because I was only 15 and I couldn't be on my own just yet. And he lived in a house with his new wife and more children, and I moved in there and became the outcast of that house. Like, I came from the city into a very rural, like where we lived, they were about 5 years behind the city I lived in. So I went in there with my long hair and my earrings and my bracelets and wanting to be a rock star. And I walked into these guys who were baling hay and feeding their horses. So I did not fit in there either. And it just became worse for me. Like, I became more. And then, because I'm unique in that environment, like, I wasn't unique where I was from, but I was unique there. Again, I became, somewhat, I want to say popular, but I don't know popular. I became known, right? And because I was different than everybody else, I became interesting, right? And then I was still carrying on because I found the guys that wanted to drink, right? Drugs weren't very common up there, but I had been, I was using drugs where I was from. And I got up there, and I think the biggest thing they were into was weed, right? But I had already done chemicals at that point, right? But if anything, it kind of slowed me down because then I just drank and smoked weed. And to me, that was just like, oh, well, everybody does that. That wasn't even extreme to me. That was what I thought people did, right? So drinking and smoking weed, no big deal. But when you're drinking excessively to blackout points at 15 years old, and I'm not even realizing, I thought that's what you did.
Tell us about some of your experiences with family during holiday seasons. Now, were holiday seasons something that you looked forward to, or did they become something that you dreaded because shit was going to go sideways?
Well, when I was a kid, I didn't know that it was different. So to me, it was like, well, Santa's coming and all that good stuff, right? And I
Santa
remember
came?
oh, he did. But I
Santa
remember
came.
1 year my mom told me the truth. I think I was like 9 or 10. I mean, when you kind of know when you're a kid, but you don't want to kind of admit it,
My
because then
son's there now.
he might
My
not
son.
come.
Yeah, he's 10 years old now and he's like still hanging on to it. And like, I'm like, I want to tell him. And like, I'm having this internal struggle. So, anyways.
Right. Well, what happened was my mom told me the truth because she didn't know if there were going to be presents under the tree. So she kind of broke that to me at like 10 years old, right? But Christmas Eve was always a party, and New Year's Eve was even worse. Like, and then as I came into my own and I wasn't at home and I was partying, I was just sharing this with a friend today that New Year's Eve became like New Year's month, right? Like, the party with me, as soon as I was on my own, the party didn't stop. And really, like, I only put a little bit of time in between using when I had to, right? And as a kid, like, to me, I looked forward to it because I got to see people. There was always people there, so I got to see them, and that was exciting to me. But when I realized what was going on in retrospect, it wasn't good. And then, like, to wake up Christmas morning and people are still up drinking sometimes, and that's not anything a kid should deal with. But I did the same thing. Like, I did the same thing to my kids as I got older because, again, like, even when I knew better, I was so locked into my way of thinking and my behaviors that, once you acknowledge there's a problem, then change has to happen, right? So that's a big
Well,
thing. Like,
it screws up your partying. Once you like, okay, this is a problem, then partying really isn't ever the same. In fact, I would argue that the party is now over and now it's just like survival.
Well, when I relapsed, like, I was in my form of recovery for about 4 years. And when I relapsed, because I mean, I stopped doing hard drugs for 4 years, but I was still drinking, right? Believing that I wasn't an alcoholic, I was a drug addict, right? I was in that mindset, right? So I would continue to drink like an idiot and drink excessively to the point of blackout still, but still believed I was clean because I wasn't doing my drugs of choice. When I did relapse, I was on a 2 year run. It took using once to put me on a 2 year run before I got clean in 2021. And I don't remember enjoying that once, not one time, but the insanity did not allow me to stop. And I hated it every time I did it for 2 years. And I could not stop.
So
Right.
you mentioned here now that you treated your own kids in a similar way.
Yeah.
What thoughts went through your head when you got the news that you were going to be a dad? Did the thought that I'm going to change pop in, or not so much?
Not even a little bit, because in my life, a father's role was so minimal that it was like, okay, cool. We're having a kid. Awesome. You know, I'll have this little child that I'll mold after myself as if, you know, you need another version of me running around at this point. Mm-hmm. And the sad thing, like if I have any, you know, I don't want to say regret because I try not to live in regret, but you know, we were young, me and my children's mother, and I refused to contribute as a human being. And I watched this mother snap into motherhood, and she's a fantastic mother. There's no love lost between us as people, but she's a fantastic mother. And my kids, you know, like she looked after them, and here's, you know, a guy who wants to party every night, won't even get his ass out of bed, you know, and she's working a job, raising kids. And, you know, at a very, very young age, like 17, 18 years old, and I'm just out trying to be a rock star, acting like a clown, and she's raising kids. Right. Mm-hmm. And I just, there was no fear in me because there was no responsibility on my end, you know, and it's shameful behavior now, but you know what I mean? Fortunately, my children have great mothers, you know, because, you know, they were always cared for, and, they're doing well in their lives today. Mm-hmm. And that's not my doing, you know what I mean? And as much as I want to go, that's my kids, you know, didn't we do, it's like, it had nothing to do with me.
So were you estranged from them, or like,
no, I was there, and that's probably the worst part.
Yeah.
Right. Like I was like I treated my kids like they were my friends. And I'll tell you a really profound moment is, so like I said, the parties, because I saw it, I had no problem bringing the parties around my kids. Right. Uh-huh. So I remember one time, there's two mothers in the mix. I have two children with one mother and another one with another woman. And the older two, I remember they were just little, and their mother said to me, Chad, like, I don't want this shit around my kids anymore. And I was like, why? Like, what is your problem? In my head, I'm going, she thinks she's better than us. Mm. Right. And she goes like, 'cause this isn't good behavior around children. And I go, what are you talking about? I said, my best memories growing up, you know, are people around the tables with guitars singing and drinking and having a good time. And she looked at me and she's like, wow, that's very sad. And I go, what? She goes, your greatest moments as a child that you remember are people around the table drunk around kids. Right. And yeah. I never, and in my heart, I just felt that, oh it my clicked. God, like, whoa. Right. And at the time though, I was so stubborn in my ways of thinking that I was going, you know, how dare you say something, but she was so right.
How long did it take you to process that to a place where it made sense? And like, you stopped being mad at her?
Only in the last 2 years, brother. Only in the last 2 years since this round of recovery for me.
Yeah.
Because I would never, to me, it was just impossible to surrender. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't understand what that meant. I thought, you know, basically when I got into recovery, anytime I would attempt it, it was to learn how to use drugs successfully. That's all I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I didn't really ever want to stop. I just wanted my life to be different because it sucked so bad all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to do the work. I wanted to do it my way. And I kept trying to do it my way.
So there were times in your life, how many times were there that you, I mean, maybe you woke up, maybe you had a foxhole prayer, you woke up in a jail cell or wherever. Was there a lot of those times where you're like, I got to stop drinking?
There was a lot of it, but it was more when the drugs came into a more common practice. So it's like, I woke up in it. Like I remember getting arrested. I was leaving a crack house with my daughter's mother, and my daughter was in the back seat, and it was the Thursday before a Good Friday, and we pulled into the liquor store, and she went in to get booze, and I had like a half ounce of drugs in my pocket and a bunch of money and stuff. And my 1-year-old daughter was in the back seat of the car, and she was only a year old, and we got surrounded at gunpoint at the liquor store. Whoa. And I woke up and I was so afraid to move because I thought they were going to shoot me, and I thought she would get hit, and it was terrifying. Right. And the worst part about that, and this is how sick I was, is, they took us to the police station and they charged me, and I could hear my daughter screaming, crying in the police station. And I said to the police officer, I said, like, if you let me out of these cuffs, I said, I'm not going anywhere. I can console her. I said, and you won't have to listen to her scream. And the cop said to me, if you cared about your daughter, you wouldn't be being charged with felony drug possession, you piece of shit. And at that point, it didn't matter to me. Like when I, so he was right. I couldn't argue with it. And there was a really big sinking feeling. But within an hour of being in that jail cell, I knew that I was going to start getting sick. And I didn't care anymore where my daughter was or where her mother was. It was, I'm going to be sick. And these withdrawals are going to be so bad because the chemicals that I was using, the withdrawals are horrible. And I just knew that the fear of being sick concerned me more than where my daughter was at that point. Right? And those are awful things to admit, but if I don't admit those things, there's no way to fix them. Right?
Is that what brought you into recovery?
I know. You'd think so, right? But not even close,
We're
not
not
for
even
many years after
halfway.
that. Yeah, that's, I bet you that's not even the halfway point. And I and as soon as I got out, I found dope, so I wasn't sick, and nothing changed. I even went to rehab. I went to rehab twice and got out and still continued to drink because I
Like
was not doing my drug of choice.
not even a breath taken before you were in the bottle?
I got kicked out of rehab at, I was in a long-term one. So I went to a short-term one and realized I needed to go for longer. And I went into a long-term one. And in 4 months, because I just refused to accept that I was a drug addict, I couldn't say the word addict. I couldn't admit I was an addict. And they ended up letting me go because they're just like, we can't help you. Right? So they kicked me out. And within getting off the bus or the train, sorry, I was already had a guy lined up and I was already drinking. But I wasn't going to do drugs this time because I was good. Right? I'd learned my lesson, right? And it didn't change. And then it wasn't, you know what I mean? Like I was going to a 12-step program, I realized like I had to try something, and that was the only thing I hadn't tried because the thought of a 12-step program, I was not interested in that, not even a little bit. It seemed too culty. You know what I mean? Like the chanting, the praying, the
There's
hugging,
chanting. There is some
Yeah,
chanting. Oh, I never
there is.
realized there is chat at the end of the NA meetings. They say the just for
All of
today
it.
thing and they chant. Oh my God.
Third step prayer, the serenity prayers, like
Well, that's not
they're
a chant. That's a
chanting, man.
prayer. That's a prayer. That's not a
Right.
chant. But
Okay.
okay, we've discovered
It's
that there's
very
chanting
culty.
at NA meetings, and now I mean, I love the program, but I do poke fun at it,
Me
so
too, yeah. Well, it saved my life, right? But I mean, I remember like thinking when I walk in and they'd hug me, and I was thinking that was fucking weird, right? And it would be like, I could sit in the same clothes for 3 days with the same three guys, picking stuff off the carpets, looking out the curtains. But if you hug me, you're the weirdo. You know what I mean? Like just a mess. But I could not. So I didn't stop. I was actually collecting clean time. I was sponsoring people and I was still drinking. Right. And it's just, I was totally disrespecting a program that saved my life or was saving my life. Right. And I felt there were bits in there where I started to kind of get it, but I remember like one of my best friends to this day, he had said to me, I felt really stuck in recovery, and it's because I hadn't been in recovery. I was still using. And he said to me, you haven't fully surrendered. And I didn't understand what that meant because I had quit doing my drug of choice. And what does that mean? I haven't surrendered. Of course I've surrendered. I'm not doing drugs. I'm only drinking, and I'm not an alcoholic. I'll drink till I black out still, but I'm not an alcoholic. I can quit anytime I want, but I don't. So yeah, and then it wasn't like they always say in recovery, don't date in the first year, right?
They do say
Well,
that.
I don't know if that works because I've never known anybody to do it, so I don't know if that's real. And that's exactly what happened. I met somebody, and I ended up within the year marrying them, right? And yeah, and we decided at that point, it was shortly after we got married, that we didn't need a program. We were good,
You're going to sponsor each
right?
other.
Oh, absolutely. And we weren't like those people, right? And when we walked out in a hail of gunfire. Like, F you guys, we're better than you. You guys are a
Oh,
mess.
man.
F this program. This is bullshit. And We walked out, and I'm telling you, within a year, I was working. I like when I'm not playing music, I detail cars, and I work out of a shop in Oshawa here. And I look, a car had pulled out, and I looked down, and I found an 8-ball of my drug of choice, and that was the downfall, because I called home and I said I found this, and she actually begged me not to bring it home. And I said, we can do this once and we're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Right. And I brought it home, and that was the end. That was the spiral down. There was no coming back from that. And that turned, for me, it turned into a 2-year run.
Yeah.
You know, and it resulted in the end of my marriage. And you know what I mean? I carried a lot of guilt, and I stayed in that situation a lot longer than I should have.
Yeah.
You know, because of the guilt, like I carried a lot of guilt for poisoning my home. Right. Mm-hmm. And I got to be honest, it still kind of stings a little bit, yeah. You know, not the loss of the marriage per se, but the fact that I'm, you know, I poisoned my house and, you know, but, you know, I brought drugs home once, you mm-hmm. know, and it just, you know, the rest of the behavior becomes, you have to own your part in things at some point.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I got clean in a house with a using addict. Mm-hmm. And that's really, really hard to do. And, you know, while I'm trying to maintain any type of recovery, the goings on in my home, it was awful. Mm-hmm. And I lost my daughter out of that deal, because my daughter's 15 years old. And, you know, we kept things, I thought, pretty under wraps. But when I got clean, I seen just how obvious it was, because I saw it, right? Under the guise, you know, in my home, you know, it was under the guise we were both clean, but it didn't take me long to figure out that she wasn't. And my daughter sadly saw a lot, the things I promised to protect her from, she ended up seeing.
Yeah.
And at 14, she had enough maturity and knew the boundaries to pull away. And now I don't have a relationship with her today because of it. And, you know, sadly, I didn't lose her because of my behavior. I lost her because of my lack of being able to set proper boundaries in my home. Because I'd never been on the receiving end of addiction before.
So hang on a second here now. So you sure. You were abstinent when you found the 8-ball?
Yeah. Well, aside from drinking, I hadn't done any drugs.
So we're still differentiating right? The two?
No, not for me now, but that was my way of thinking then. Okay. No differentiation. Okay. So I was not abstinent. No.
Okay. So you found this 8-ball, you go home, y'all tie into it.
Yep.
And then 2 years go by, heavy using, both of you, daughter at
every
home.
Day. She wasn't living with us, but
okay.
I had her regularly, my daughter.
Okay. Now,
yeah.
Then you decide to get sober, and you're continuing to live with your wife, correct?
Well, I was, yeah, absolutely. And here's the thing. So I woke up May of 2021, mm-hmm. and I don't know, like, you know, people can talk about their spirituality, and I respect wherever you're at with that, whatever that is for you. I hope I'm not crossing any boundaries here, but I say God, right? Oh, for lack of a better, you know what I mean? For me, it's God. There's no question to me where my faith is. So I woke up May of 2021, and I had been using all night, and me and my wife had been using all night. And I woke up, and I don't know what happened, but something, it was like, I knew I was done, and I couldn't, like, I usually when I wake up and I don't have dope, I'm angry, I'm miserable. And then my daughter was out sleeping on the couch, and I was supposed to spend the day with her, which I ended up doing. But I usually don't look forward to that because I'm strung out and I'm sick and mm-hmm. I'm miserable mm-hmm. and I hate my life. And now I'm just going through the motions as a shitty dad. Right. Mm-hmm. So I woke up and I knew that I had to be done. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I got like something just said, like, you can't do this anymore. And I got down on my knees and in front of my couch, and I, no word of a lie, I looked up at the sky with my hands, and I just was like, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And everything, it was like an explosion in my head. Like all the answers just came flooding to a point where I couldn't deny it. And I'm not talking metaphorically or any, it was like the answers were just like, you don't have another time in you.
What were the answers?
It was, you got to get better and you have to be a better man. And if you don't, you're going to die. Your wife is going to die. You're the only child that's active in your life right now will want nothing to do with you.
So it doesn't sound to me like those are all the answers came to you. It sounds to me like a bunch of acceptance came to you. Like, these are the things there that are going to happen. Right.
Yeah. And I just knew that I didn't want that. I knew that I was exhausted, and I was sick of lying, and I was sick of portraying this image of a man who had it together and pretending I wasn't afraid. You know, and not to mention, I had built a bunch of strong friendships in my fake recovery, and I had been distancing from them because I was using, and everybody kind of knew what was going on. And I had walked out of that program like this, you know, and tucking my tail between my legs and walking in and going, you guys were right. I can't do this by myself, you know, and getting that white key tag again. You know, there was a lot of pride. And when I realized that there's no pride in being a piece of shit, and that's what I was being, right? I was not, there was nothing good about anything I was doing. You know, the only thing was, is my rock bottom looked so different this time, because it was a spiritual rock bottom. Like, I wasn't homeless. I still had a job. I was still working every day. You know, I wasn't all thin and gross like I was the first time I tried to come into recovery. I still put on it, like, I looked good, I smelled good. So I convinced everybody that I was good. So my rock bottom, it was more spiritual, like I was broken on the inside, and I had nothing left in me. And my marriage was done. Like, it was done. And I'm finding, you know, paraphernalia in the house. And then it just got to a point where I was just exhausted. And it was either, you know, it got to a point where I wasn't worried I was going to overdose or anything anymore. I was worried that I was probably going to kill myself, because I just didn't want to be here anymore.
Like, not, okay.
Not hypothetically. I was like,
you're
going to
off yourself. You had a plan?
I was done. I thought it through.
There was some planning. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where is your then wife? Where is she now?
The last I heard, you know, the small conversations I've had with her over the last little while, she claims to be clean. The conversations and the messages, you know, the text messages tell me a very different story, but, I don't think she's doing well, but it's, you know, it's not my story to tell. I only at this point pray that she doesn't die.
So
and
I
that's
guess
where I'm at, you know.
The reason I ask that is not necessarily to hear her story, but to learn about how you feel about that when you guys were maybe not necessarily doing perfectly, but you were at a better place, and then you brought this bag home even after she like begged you not to, and now she's off in the sticks somewhere. Like, how do you deal
with
that?
Well, the problem is and I'll say this because I have nothing to hide, is it's like, I really tried to love her and separate her from the addict. But the problem is that the addict took over to such a degree that you can only be lied to and stolen from. And you know what I mean? To a point where, you know, I had to go like, okay, man, like, I cannot do this anymore. And it was really hard for me because I didn't want to walk away from the marriage. I really didn't. But it was like, we're both going to die. Or I'm going to live and hopefully, you know, be there when you get better. But now that's not even an option. You know what I mean? Like, my life has progressed to such a degree that I'm past the point of being able to even reach back. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I've moved on, and, you know, it's unfortunate because, you know, I can walk away today saying that I really gave everything in me, and trying to love an addict is hard. And if anything, it showed me what many people went through with me.
Yeah.
You know, and people who, you know, you can only grab somebody like this so many times and go, I need you to hear me, you know, and for them to just, you know, the disease has taken over to such a degree. And drugs are the smallest problem.
Yeah.
You know, when it's The way, when you do the step work, you get into the behaviors and your character defects. And getting off drugs for me, when I decided to do it, was the easiest part.
Yeah.
It was dealing with who I was. Like I ran my life on drugs and character defects. Yeah. You take the drugs out of that, what am I?
Yeah. Well, they were the solution at the time, weren't they?
Yeah. And now I realize, like, do you know how bad it sucks to know that when you take drugs out of the equation that you're still shitty?
Right? Maybe even more so.
Right. Because you're realizing like those thoughts are still there. Those behaviors, you still want to do them. You know, they're not acceptable.
Yeah.
But now there's nothing stopping. You know what I mean? Like,
it's like
before you were uninhibited.
Steve-O, I think of Steve-O, and I don't know exactly the words verbatim that he uses, but I heard him say in an interview once that he didn't experience the worst part of his alcoholism and his addiction until he stopped using and drinking.
Well, I went through my biggest challenges in recovery, right? Because I had to go through the feels. Like, I don't want to tell the truth all the time.
Yeah.
I don't want to live in God's will.
I'm not so sure any of us want to tell the truth all the time. Like, even like whether there's drugs involved or recovery or not, like, I think human beings just struggle with the truth.
Well, and that's the thing, like, and that was the hardest part, like the things that were happening to me. So when I got clean, I had never been, like I said, on the receiving end of an addict's behavior. Right. So in recovery, I was still dealing with this. So you got to figure someone who is in active use trying to paint an ugly picture of someone else to take the emphasis off them, like the gaslighting and the narcissism that comes with addiction, right? So when somebody's trying to paint an ugly picture of you and saying things about you that aren't true, and you wake up in a jail cell on a false domestic charge, and in your mind you're going like, how could somebody do this to you? I'm sitting there clean, dealing with this kind of stuff, to take the emphasis off of their behaviors, right? And it's like, I have to do a check, because I remember doing not doing things like that per se, but the things I would do to take the emphasis off myself. Right? And it's like trying to understand those things. And like, so when those things were happening to me in, while I was clean, my instinct is to defend myself, right? I'm not doing all those things. But then people are going, but you're living with a using addict. What do you think is going to happen? And then I remember a really profound moment, was actually her daughter said to me, she's like, I know my mom's a mess, but I know I'm now wondering what is wrong with you. Right.
Because you're sticking
around.
And that
was a big moment for me. Yeah. You're dealing with this constantly. Right. And that was a very profound moment for me to go like, I want different for my life. And today, what I want in my life is non-negotiable. Right. Like, I don't negotiate with anybody for what I want for my life today.
Yeah.
And I will never do that in my next situation. I will never do that for anybody, because I know now what I can have in recovery. And even in the small, like the 2.5 years now that I've been clean, May of 2021, I got clean for real. That was when I got in front of my couch. Just the turn that my life has taken. I cannot accept anything less than my worth today. And I don't love necessarily what I see in the mirror today. I just know today that I don't hate it. Right. And there's a big difference, because there was a time I couldn't stand my own skin. Like, I would get out of the shower and my skin would be scalded, because it just felt like I had to burn the ugly off of it or something. Right. And I'm not like that today, because I know I'm not who I was, and that was due to doing the work. Like, getting off dope, like I said, was the easiest part.
Yeah.
Doing that work, that's hard.
So let's talk about that then. You talk about doing the work, and everybody always says, you got to do the work. You got to do the work. And like, even 7 years in, and I'm having conversations with people who also have significant time under their belt, and we still struggle sometimes to know what the work is. What is the work?
For me, it's living in my steps. Like, I do my steps once a year without fail, so I have to live in them, because I remember my sponsor, he said to me, he used the analogy of doing, like when you relapse, you basically start doing your steps, living in your steps backwards. So you stop carrying the message, and then you stop conscious contact, and then you start causing new harms, and you by the end of it, you forget that you're a drug addict, and you start, acting out in your selfishness, self-centered. Like if you look at that in reverse, it's the typical road to relapse, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, I live in my steps. Like, I'm not above breaking character. Trust me. Like, mm-hmm. I can be just as much of an asshole sometimes, but the difference is today is I can recognize when I've done something wrong, right? I get to, acknowledge that, and that's not always easy. Yeah. I'm trying to stay humble. That's hard. Not because I think I'm great, but because, when somebody said to me one time, it's not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. Mm. Right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I remember a guy said to me, I didn't think a lot of myself, but I was all I thought about. Right? Yeah. And it's like getting out of that how is this affecting me? And it's like, no, like how is the other people feeling in this situation? What's my role in it? If I have a resentment with somebody, I have to have a part in that somewhere.
Yeah.
My sponsor is really great at pointing, like bringing it all back to me. You know what I mean? And it's hilarious because I remember one of the biggest ones was, again, I'm going to have to share a personal opinion on this. Like, so one of my resentments was with my youngest daughter's mother. And my sponsor said to me, "Why is that?" And I said, "Well, because she's 14 and they vaccinated her and I'm not okay with that." Right. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, who's your resentment with? Like, really, who's your resentment with?" And he goes, "Why didn't you tell her not to do it?" And I said, "Because I don't have any say in that." And he goes, "And why don't you have any say in it?" And I'm like, "Because she has full custody." And she goes, "Why does she have full custody?" Right. And then I had to bring it back to because I'm a shitty dad and she's got custody of my daughter. So that resentment had nothing to do with her. It was me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Had I been able to have a say, had I done the work in the first place and not been who I was, I'd have a say in that situation. And I don't today. So my resentment is not with her. It's with me.
Have your children responded to the way that you've changed your life? Like, have they allowed you back in any way?
My son and me, we have a really good relationship today, but it's because I step back and I just let him be his own person. I always want to help him, right? Like, I always want to, when I feel, because he's 28 and he's got his own way of thinking and it's very different from mine, right? And I see a lot of characteristics in him that remind me of me, right? Mm-hmm. And it scares me because I always fear, because I know what those thoughts and feelings and behaviors, how that affected me, and I want to save him and protect him, but that's not for me to do. And I don't get to just walk in and be like, "Now you're going to listen to your dad." Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. My middle daughter is 26. She's a nurse. I have zero relationship with her. She calls another man dad, and that guy earned it. Mm-hmm. It was ironic because I went to speak at a treatment center one time, and she was actually the nurse that came out to give me a COVID test before I could walk in. And I had not seen her in 6 years.
Uh-huh.
And I looked at her, I go, "You're going to jam that thing in my head, aren't you?" And she goes, "It's going to hurt." And that was the most conversation we had in years. And she made it hurt. Let me tell you, I felt that in my eyeball.
Yeah.
But, and my youngest daughter, like I said, she's got boundaries today and she lives with her mom, and her mom's married to a really great man, a man that I message on Father's Day and thank him.
Mm-hmm.
I say, "Thank you for being there when I'm not," because he's a good man. And there's a good family unit there. And if either of my daughters choose to be around, I'm in a state today where I can, receive it properly and not be so quick to tell them what I'm doing. A good sign that somebody's not doing well is when they probably tell you how well they're doing.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So if and when either of my daughters want to show up at my door, it'd be great to just ask them how they are.
Mm-hmm.
How are you?
That's interesting that you, because last week, sorry, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because just last Friday, I had a man in the studio here by the name of Larry Foster. We had a great conversation with him. It was a great episode. And he said very much that same thing, maybe in some different words, but it's like, you don't need to tell everybody everything. You don't need to, like if you're having anxiety in your day, there's no reason to throw that anxiety up all over everyone else. you know, because maybe necessarily these people are having good days and they're having a good experience and they don't want to sit there and listen to you and be your counselor for the next hour and a half, you know, but yeah, that's because like that's accountability, right?
Right. You don't have to dump your life on everybody when you meet them.
Yeah.
Right. Save that for your sponsor or your best friend. Like,
man,
I used to do that for the lack of having an outlet. Like, again, yeah. When I didn't have anybody, when you met me within 5 minutes, you would know I'm a drug addict. I'm a shitty dad. I'm this,
yeah.
I'm that.
Yeah.
I'm a horrible spouse. And then it'd be like, you know, but to me, that was almost defense. Like, now you already know all the shitty things. What else you got?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I would tell the person in the line in the grocery store, the person in front of me, I would tell them my life story, man. I feel sorry for some of those people when I was like a couple of months in recovery. Right? Holy cow, man. I would tell everybody anything.
When I got my 2-year medallion, what happened is I was really bad for exposing everything.
Mm.
Like when, you know, especially when you have two people that are married in the rooms, right? People know that there's chaos going on. Mm-hmm. And my instinct was to sit in the share circle and just start like sharing my personal shit as though it was a step four, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? And I'm just sitting there and in retrospect, like it's embarrassing when I think about what I was doing. And I vowed on my 2-year medallion, I was like, from now on, I'm going to recover out loud and live in silence. You know what I mean? Like, and now like I live a life where I keep it to myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I do recover out loud, but like anything I'm sharing is pretty much past tense because what's going on with me today, as far as anything too personal, I keep it to myself because there's no need, you know, until I decide that it's something that I want to share. I don't need to, you know, throw out a bunch of maybes to the world.
Yeah.
You know, it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
You know,
So you're a musician, you're a singer, you're a guitarist, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
A little bit of guitar, but I sing in my band.
Okay. Valier is the name of the band, correct?
Yes, sir.
How has that changed? Has your music changed since you got sober?
It got a lot better. Well, it's funny because, I'd done it for so many years and I did not know how to, I was terrified that I wasn't going to know what to write about, not to mention walking into a bar the first time, you know, 2.5 years ago, you know, and playing and not doing a few lines and a couple shots before I walked on stage. And if anything, like, it's funny because me and my guitar player were driving into a rehearsal and he's known me, my guitar players know me for like, you know, probably almost 20 years. And he said to me, you know, you're so far removed from the person you were in active use. And, you know, when I listen to the recordings of our playing, like we're just so much tighter and my voice doesn't blow out. And I'm just in, you know, at the peak of my game. And when I got clean, we got signed, you know, we signed a worldwide distribution deal with a record label. Like who does that in their 40s? You know, so when people say it's too late, I mean, it's never too late, you know, and, you know, my music changed in the sense that if anything, I can do it a lot more in depth and not just surface bullshit crying about my problems. Like I can actually look deeper into my psyche or into what's going on around me and write about that or things that are affecting me in a way, but my pen far from dried up. And I thought for sure it was going to,
and it
did not.
So is there anything else?
We mentioned earlier, like the documentary, it's been cleaning up film festivals all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like I can't even believe what's been happening with that. Like every time I turn around, and because of the success of the documentary, you know, we're up to like 19 or 20 laurels, you know, and I've got trophies. Like, I mean, there's some back here, you know, things that are happening. And because of that, now I've got a book deal. So I'm writing a book as we speak.
Oh, wow.
And I'm about 150 pages into that. Mm-hmm. And that's very cathartic, but it's also very draining at times because I got to remember some stuff. I got to touch on abuse as a child. And I told them right from the get-go, it can't be about my face in that camera. You know, this has to be a reason to help and bring awareness to, you know, childhood sexual abuse and addiction, right?
Hang on a second.
I'm a survivor.
You didn't even touch on that.
Yeah, well, at you know, I can't remember how old I was. I was like 4 or 5-ish. There was a hardcore sexual assault happened to me. I was violently raped by an uncle, and that I believe changed the course of my life forever. Right, like that was the beginning. And you know, I it's so funny because I can't believe we didn't touch on that because that was the beginning of everything going south for me.
Do you remember it?
Right,
Or was this you were told?
What I remember the most, and again, like this could get uncomfortable, and just a warning, but I just remember it being very uncomfortable and not understanding what was going on because I was so little, right? And I remember how violent it was, and you know, addicts, I don't know, like if all addicts are like me and my crew of addicts, but you know, we make humor out of the worst situations and we find it funny, and I always make the joke like, you know. There was no, here's a piece of candy, don't tell your mom. I feel a little jaded that I didn't even get the candy. You
That's
know,
called
but
that
that,
there's a term for that. That's called survivor's humor.
yeah. Well, it you know, it is, and you know, I try to make the best of you know, I had it took me a long time to realize it. So, you know, you're as sick as your secrets, and I kept that secret because you know, whenever you a pedophile is caught. First thing they say is it happened to me. And the last thing I ever wanted anybody to think is that I could do anything like that to a child. So I kept that secret for years. And it fueled and then even when it became common knowledge, you know, there's people in my family who don't believe it still, and that's fine. I don't care. But it took me a long time to understand that that had nothing to do with me. Right? That was a sick, sick man who took advantage of a child, right? And then the overcompensation that comes with you know, with that. So to me, keep in mind things were a lot different back then. So, you know, I didn't want to be seen as gay.
Even at 5 years old, you were concerned
No, it was
about.
when I got older, there was a reason I was overcompensating, right? Like
Okay,
as I got
okay.
older and part promiscuity gets into the drug use. No, at 5 years old, I didn't even know what gay was,
Yeah.
right? But it's like, and there's no hate in my heart for anybody. I want that very clear. Like
Yeah.
I'm okay with anything. I don't care who you are and how you identify and all that. There's no hate in my heart for anybody. But when I was young, you keep in mind, like I'm in my late 40s. Times were
Yeah.
different, and I didn't want to be seen as something that was already like I was already feeling alienated. I did not want to feel anything that was going to alienate me more. Right? So there was overcompensation. So I had to have the prettiest girl on my arm. I had to have the best dope. I had to have the, you know, the best party, you know, and that's what always happened.
So when it happened, were you, and it doesn't sound like he said keep it a secret or anything like that.
Oh, he was a terrifying man. I didn't say anything at all.
Did he
I
threaten
knew
you?
better. Like he didn't have to. He didn't have to.
Okay.
He was such a terrifying man to children and
Yeah.
to women. Like that was his trip, right? Like he was under the guise of, like I said, I grew up around you know, a lot of guys in motorcycle clubs and he was not a member of any club, but he carried himself as though. So he was a kind of man that you wouldn't expect that from, because in that circle, that stuff is very frowned upon,
Yeah.
right? Like, you know, bad things happen to people who do things to children in that group. So, you know, there was no nobody would ever assume that he would do something like that, you know. And it was funny. I actually came out with it because he had done it to someone else, and this person was being called a liar. Like, there's no way this guy did this. And I wondered how many more people it had been done to. And so I had to, you know, swallow my pride, swallow my shame, and admit that it happened, so that maybe the next person that came forward, you know. They wouldn't be looked at and called a liar, because this went to court too, and because this person was so afraid, you know, there were some inconsistencies in his story, and he was found not guilty. But I know it happened, and there's a reason why I know it happened, right? So I had to come forward and say, like, and nothing changed in that regard for that person who came forward, but at least now, you know, there's more people who know it's true, and this person can be seen for who he is, right?
So what was that like for you? Now, and in case somebody out there is watching who has been through something similar and is scared to bring it to light, tell us about your experience in bringing that forward. Were you shunned by the family? Were you accepted? Was there, like, tell us about it.
Well, it wasn't overly talked about. Like some of my sisters and I have had some in-depth conversations, but what it did for me was it made me very protective of my children, right? So it was like, my son, he had a really close friend, and he would go away on camping trips with his friend and his dad. And in my head, I was always worried, like maybe this dad's a weirdo, like things like that. No matter where my kids were, I was always worried something may or may not happen to them. Because it always happens in the least expected places. And it's like, I just was always on guard, and it got to a point where that was one of the breaking points for me, is I ended up having sort of a breakdown overthinking some things that I thought were happening, to my children that weren't. And I ended up having a very big breakdown over it and coming to terms with it after that. Like, okay, nothing's happening to my kids. This is in my head. I've manifested this thing that's not real because I'm afraid of these things happening to my children, and I ended up, it was a breakdown, but a breakthrough. Right. And it happened in my like early 20s. So it didn't change my lifestyle. It just gave me more reason to be a shitbag, right?
So are you saying that this is when you remember, because I've had people on in the past
Sure.
who have had, I would say, similar things happen to them, and
Yeah.
they repressed it, and then suddenly, one person that's coming to mind right now was into his 20s, I believe, and something happened that cued the memory, and then it all came flooding back. Like he had completely repressed it. How was
Well, that's
did
exactly what the breakdown was. So like
Okay.
I had put it so far in the back of my head, right? And like I said, I didn't understand the overcompensation. Like I didn't understand what was happening. And if you called me the F word, I would be ready to stick you in the neck with something, and things like that. I didn't understand why these things were so excessive to me, right? And why I was so worried about my kids when there was no reason to be. Why did I think all this was going on? So as these things are, I said, happening, when I had that breakdown, that was when I realized that it had happened. And then all of a sudden, like the images became very clear, and I remembered, somewhat what it was, right? And then it took me a lot more time to actually come out with it, because I had to understand what the uncomfortability was, what the pain was, what the physical soreness was. Like I didn't understand what those things were. So I figured that out as I got older. And it's graphic and it's ugly, but it happened, right? And those are the things, there's people who will die because they're afraid to talk about this. And that can't happen anymore on my watch. Like I cannot watch people die because I'm ashamed of something that I had nothing to do with. And that's not fair. Like I watched a guy speak not long ago, and our lives draw similar parallels. And he, when he shared his story, he talked about when he had to come to terms with it, and it was because someone he like someone had killed themselves, because of it. And in his mind, in his heart, he felt like he may as well have pulled the trigger because it happened to him and he did nothing about it, right? So it's like I cannot watch people die because they're afraid to be honest, or get or this shame that is put on us, as weak or something we're not, right?
Do you ever get people treating you differently when they learn this about you?
I was actually afraid with the documentary. I was very afraid because I put it out there, right? And now, like, when you watch that documentary, I'm the guy who that happened to, and it's like, people who don't even know me now, like, and I don't know that anybody's treating me different, but I know that I'm feeling different about it, right? So it's like when you put something that big out there and you do it regularly, like this isn't the first time I've had a public conversation about it, right? So when you put that out there, now you're that guy, now people know. So I mean, I don't know if like I don't think I'm being treated different, but I know I definitely feel different about it. I feel like I'm being looked at different.
Is
Right.
your abuser, is he still around?
Yeah. And this the thing is so like I said, I detail cars, but this where I detail cars, there's we also wash them, like we do quick in and outs and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So what happened was my first year of real recovery, like so in 2021, I was washing a car and I went over the windshield and I looked down and I saw his tattoo on his arm.
Uh-huh.
And I remember it from, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was at my job and I started shaking and I went in the back room and my boss came in. He's like, "What are you doing?" And I was kind of curled up in a ball, like in the fetal position.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I didn't know, cause my street brain, addict brain, wanted to pull him out of the car and beat him with whatever I could find and beat him to death.
Yeah.
Right. But my recovery brain and my sponsor, the guy who I'm accountable to and the people in my recovery circle, you know, would never allow me to do that. And they would be there for me to talk me through it. So the first thing I did, I had to tell my boss what was going on. And that was embarrassing.
Yeah.
Because here I am and I'm not a small guy. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm covered in tattoos and I'm not known for being weak. And here I am curled up in the fetal position because I want to murder this man.
So you were removing yourself from that situation because you were angry, not because you were scared.
No, I wanted to kill him.
Genuinely.
And I had to because not hypothetically. Okay. Like it was like I had prayed and I know it's sick, but I had prayed for that moment to see mm-hmm. him in real life because I wanted to deal with him. And thank God that I was in recovery at that point, because if I wasn't, my life would be very different today. And so would his, if he even had one left.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But I called my sponsor and he was in a meeting, so he couldn't take my call. But, you know, I don't know if you know, but I have a power of five, I call it. And there's a guy that, you know, the next best thing is like my best friend, Ryan. And I called him and I said to him and I told him what was going on and he knew. And I called him and I was crying. And the first thing he said to me was, you know, "I'm really sorry you're dealing with this right now." And I said, "I don't know what to do." And he said to me, "Pray for him." Hmm. I'm like, "Pray for him? Are you out of your fucking mind? Pray for him?"
Yeah.
And I go, "Why would I pray for him?" And he goes, "Because he needs it more than you."
Yeah.
And it's weird because when I did pray it out, you know, my God likes to give me empathy when I want to hurt somebody. Because when I pray it out, what happens is I start wondering what made him that monster.
Mm-hmm.
And I become less selfish. And it's so bizarre how that works. And when people say, you know, somebody said to me one time, "The only thing prayer ever changes is you." Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what it does. And when I pray that stuff out, you know, trust me, it's not easy. It's not easy not wanting to destroy the man that I feel was responsible, but I have to, again, with my resentment, I have to take responsibility at some point because it wasn't about him past a certain time.
Yeah.
It was decisions that I was making that I was really eager to blame on him.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's a hard pill to swallow.
You truly believe that we can choose how we feel?
No, but I can choose what I do with it.
Mm.
Right. Like I don't have to let anger fuel me. I don't have to, you know, here's the world doesn't care that I'm a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It doesn't. So no matter what I'm doing or what I'm feeling, I still have to eat tomorrow. So it doesn't matter what's going on in my life. I still have to get up and go to work. So mm-hmm. I can be sad. I can be angry. I can be broken. I can be, you know, having a nervous breakdown, but if I don't go to work, I don't get to eat. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and nobody has the time. And I say this often, nobody has the time to peel the onion. You know, they don't care why you're being an asshole. Uh-huh. They just see the direct result of you being an asshole. So they don't care why. The world doesn't have time to care. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't control how I feel. What I get to control is what I do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's routines that I have to follow. Like you said, doing the work earlier. Yeah. Like I have a routine that I do. And if I'm not in routine, I'm falling right back into old behaviors really fast. Yeah. Right. When I go to the gym every morning at 5 o'clock, I'm up in the morning and I walk across the street. My gym is right across the street. And then I pray and I go to work and then I try to hit a meeting if I need it. You know, I hit my home group every week, you know, and if I don't, you know, and I, you know, I try, I'll hit as many as I can. If I feel like going, sometimes I hit 4 or 5 a week.
Yeah.
Cause I enjoy them still. You know, and then I come home and I eat and I go to bed and I do the same thing the next day. And then when I can make music, I make music. When I get to spend time with my son, I'll spend time with my son. Like these are the things that I do today to ensure that I don't make poor choices.
Where can people find you? Where can they follow you? Where can they listen to your music?
Any streaming site, Spotify, Apple, YouTube. You can go on my Facebook page. You can follow Chad Valier Up From The Dark. My Facebook page is Chaddy V. Valier. The band Valier, you can look us up anywhere. I'm on everything, Twitter, all of it. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is type in my name. You can see the documentary for free on my Facebook page. Mm. Anybody that wants to watch it, and anybody that just wants to reach out, you know, if you're struggling, reach out to me, man. My sponsor said to me after I did the steps, he goes, your job now is to carry the message. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do your job, I can't do mine anymore.
All right, man. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, sir.
Thanks for sharing your story. You go. Take care, my friend. If you got something out of this, please give us a like at the bottom of the screen there. If you're not yet subscribed to us on YouTube or Apple Podcast, please do that. If you are listening to us on Apple Podcast or Spotify, please give us a 5-star rating and drop a review. Help us grow. That's all I've got for you. Take care, everyone.
Say, this is Hard Knocks Talks.